the Almighty appeared on earth as a helpless human baby, needing to be fed and changed and taught to talk like any other child. The more you think about it, the more staggering it gets. Nothing in fiction is so fantastic as this truth of the incarnation. That was J.I. Packer in his classic book, Knowing God. Christianity certainly stands or falls on the fact of the bodily resurrection, but it also stands or falls on the fact of the incarnation, that in Jesus, God the Son came into this world and took on flesh, was born a human baby. And we should be honest about this. The baby that was born in that manger divides. And not just when he grew older, but from the very moment he was born. The baby was good news of great joy, and the baby was bad news. A source of joy to some, he was a source of trouble to others. I think the reactions to the birth of this baby do tell us something about the baby himself. But I also think that the reactions tell us something about the world. They tell us something about us. If we listen, if we hear, we can see glory. Glory that is everything needful for our salvation. Now, for the last few months here, we have been in the book of Exodus, glorious book of Yahweh, the Lord, redeeming his slave people from Egypt that they might live under his rule and in his presence in promised land. Well, this morning we are exiting out of Exodus briefly for the incarnation. But these two events are not disconnected. Apart from Exodus, there is no incarnation. And in the earliest days of Jesus' own life, we see, we hear echoes of the Exodus. And we do so because the events are all part of the same story, the true story of the world, the story that right now our lives are being played out in before the God of the Exodus. So this morning, we go to Matthew's gospel. That's the first book of the New Testament, the first of four gospels, and we'll be in chapter 2, and we'll be looking at verses 13 through 23. Now, because we're jumping right into another book, I'm going to spend a bit more time than usual this morning to give you a bit more context for our text. So first, a bit about Matthew and this gospel. Matthew is no different than the other gospel writers in this way. He writes this work with an agenda. If you've got Matthew open, look at chapter 1, because Matthew very famously begins his gospel, chapter 1, verse 1, with a genealogy. I know that you often are tempted to skip genealogies when you read the Bible, but there's so much there. It's no different with this genealogy. The very word itself is the Greek word for Genesis. It's the beginning, the origin. So this gospel begins with a new beginning for the world through this man, Jesus. And through this very highly structured genealogy, Matthew is telling you at the very outset of his gospel that this Jesus is the son of David. He's the son of Abraham. And why is that important? Because God had made promises to his people, one of which was that David, the king, would have an offspring, a son, and that son would occupy his throne forever. 2 Samuel 7. And God had promised Abraham centuries before this that through his offspring, all of the world would know blessing. So Matthew's agenda for his readers who knew their Old Testament very well was for them to understand that this gospel, this account, is about the man Jesus, who is the long-promised Davidic king, the offspring of Abraham, the Messiah through whom God will bless the world. Now, I can't get into the whole genealogy, but do notice a few things about it. Notice, number one, this is a genealogy of kings, verse 6, David and Solomon. There's others as well. So Matthew is saying Jesus descended from royalty. Surprisingly, he highlights women. It would have been very surprising in that day. But he also highlights that Jesus descended from sinners and sinful events. We read of Tamar in verse 3 and Rahab in verse 5 and Bathsheba, who is called the wife of Uriah in verse 6. And the point is that this king, born in strangely lowly circumstances, comes from kings. He comes from royalty. And he comes from sinners. Because this king comes for sinners. Matthew in no way is trying to hide the embarrassing parts of the family story. He's putting them out there for the world to see. And the other thing I want you to see from this genealogy is notice the end of verse 11, the beginning of verse 12, and even down in verse 17, Matthew highlights this deportation to Babylon repeatedly. It's unusual, but what he's doing is he's setting up for us a comparison with the Exodus. Matthew means for you to see that Jesus's life patterned the life of Israel, because Jesus is the fulfillment of the life of Israel. Well, immediately after this Genesis, this new beginning, the genealogy of Jesus, we get the first of three birth stories, Matthew 1, 18 to 25. Jesus was miraculously born by the power of the Holy Spirit. His name, Jesus, means Yahweh, Yahweh saves, which was not an unusual name in his day. God's people had for centuries hoped that, so they named their baby boys Jesus or Joshua. But there's something different with Jesus, the angel makes clear. The hope is not that Yahweh will save, but that in Jesus, salvation has come. He will save his people from their sins. So he came to save, and he would need to be saved. Chapter 2, verses 1 to 12, from Herod. This is a king who from the beginning is opposed by kings. Herod, the regional ruler in Rome, verse 3, was troubled when he learned about the birth of Jesus. And he learned about it through the interpretation of the prophecy of Micah, which we read earlier. But there's hope. We also meet verse 1, chapter 2, verse 1, these Gentile wise men who, when they heard about his birth, came in verse 2 to worship him. The king hears and is troubled. The wise men hear and come to worship. So, in a chapter and a half, we have something extraordinary. A boy born who is the hope of the world, whose very birth divides the world. That's the context for our text this morning in chapter 2. The wise men depart, going another way in order to avoid the bloodthirsty Herod. So let's read verses 13 through 23. Now, when they had departed, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream and said, "Rise, take the child and his mother and flee to Egypt and remain there until I tell you, for Herod is about to search for the child to destroy him." And he rose and took the child and his mother by night and departed to Egypt and remained there until the death of Herod. This was to fulfill what the Lord had spoken by the prophet, "Out of Egypt I called my son." Then Herod, when he saw that he'd been tricked by the wise men, became furious. And he sent and killed all the male children in Bethlehem and in all that region who were 2 years old or under, according to the time that he had ascertained from the wise men. Then was fulfilled what was spoken by the prophet Jeremiah. A voice was heard in Ramah, weeping and loud lamentation, Rachel weeping for her children. She refused to be comforted because they are no more. But when Herod died, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt, saying, Rise, take the child and his mother, and go to the land of Israel, for those who sought the child's life are dead. And he rose and took the child and his mother and went to the land of Israel. But when he heard that Archelaus was reigning over Judea in place of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there. And being warned in a dream, he withdrew to the district of Galilee. And he went and lived in a city called Nazareth, so that what was spoken by the prophets might be fulfilled, that he would be called a Nazarene. Here's the main point I want you to see of this birth story of Jesus. Jesus is true Israel who fulfills God's promises and our hopes. Jesus is true Israel who fulfills God's promises and our hopes. We'll see this morning through 3 points, very simply: Exodus, exile, and return. Exodus, exile, and return. Let's begin with Exodus in verses 13 through 15. So for the second time, at least, it's possible this is the third time, because it is possible the wise men followed an angel. That was that star that they followed to Bethlehem. But at least for the second, an angel in Matthew's gospel moved from the unseen realm to the seen realm, appears. And once again, an appearing gives critical revelation in verse 13. Appearing to Joseph to give him a command. Now in the scriptures, angels never appear randomly. For the vast majority of the scriptures, they are nowhere to be seen, which of course does not mean they're inactive. They do appear more intensely at moments of critical points of God's work in redemption, when the kingdom of God is at a point of strategic advance or conflict. And in the birth of Jesus, we have both. Now we know from Hebrews 1 that angels are ministering spirits sent out to serve for the sake of those who will inherit salvation. And here, verse 13, an angel of the Lord appears to Joseph, commands him to rise and take the child and his mother to Egypt and remain there until Herod's about to search to destroy and kill this child. So by revelation, Joseph is to take the baby to Egypt, and by revelation, he will leave Egypt. Joseph is commanded to make an exodus out of the land of promise. And we read about his obedience in verses 14 to 15. Notice he was commanded by the angel to rise and take, and he rose and took the child and his mother by night. He departed to Egypt and remained there until the death of Herod. So he went by night. He obeyed immediately. He obeyed fully. Notice that God's great plan and work in redemption hinges on pivotal, faithful obediences that would have cosmic and consequential implications for the world. This is a profound birth story. And I think we should also learn from it that you never know how far-reaching the most ordinary act of obedient faithfulness might actually be. Be faithful with each opportunity the Lord gives you. Now, who was Herod? He is a man with whom so many Christians are familiar. He's also a man that so many Christians know so little about. He reigned over Judea from 37 BC to 4 AD. He was shrewd. He was cruel. From this Herod, there would come several other Herods. All of them would foolishly oppose the man Jesus. They would also oppose the risen and ascended Jesus and his followers. Because of this Herod, Joseph fled to Egypt. Now, that was an unexpected exodus, but geographically, at least, it was not an unexpected place. There was actually a decent population of Jewish people in Egypt in that day. The border of Egypt, as our Egyptian friends know, is only about 150 kilometers from Bethlehem. So this was a safe place for the family to go away from Herod's jurisdiction. Now, Matthew gives us a very straightforward rendering of this account, but he also does more than that. Again and again, you heard Matthew say this was to fulfill. And he writes that because the birth of Jesus did not happen in a vacuum. It is the climax of the story God had been bringing about in the world since the creation of it. You and I do this. We look back on our national histories. We look back on our personal histories. We interpret events. Well, in the scriptures, we get God's definitive interpretation of events in history. He tells us what the past means for the present and what the present means for the past. Matthew says that this event, Jesus exiting to Egypt, verse 15, fulfills what the Lord had spoken by the prophet. Out of Egypt, I called my son. Matthew is quoting the prophet Hosea. God had spoken through the prophets for centuries. These prophets had shaped the expectations and the hopes of this people. And Matthew, who had no doubt spent quite a bit of time reasoning and reflecting and ultimately interpreting these events as he looked back through the cross and the resurrection upon them, he saw that in these events that the Lord was doing something very significant. In the exodus to Egypt, God brought about the fulfillment of promises. Now, when the prophet Hosea had written about Israel being called out of Egypt, he was writing about just that. We read in Hosea 11, 1, when Israel was a child, I loved him. And out of Egypt, I called my son. It is what we've been immersed in for several months here. In the Exodus, the Lord, Yahweh, made his supremacy above all the gods known in delivering this people who God calls my son. In the Exodus, God, Yahweh, worked a powerful and public salvation for his slave people in the face of the world's superpower. But if you're reading this closely, you might ask, how does Matthew say that the exodus of Jesus into Egypt, not out of it, fulfills what Hosea wrote, out of Egypt, I called my son? Well, because in Jesus, God did something decisively new in the world. The son of Hosea's prophecy is the nation of Israel. But here in Jesus, we have God's unique, God's one and only son. And Matthew means for you to see that this isn't just fulfilling prophecy. Jesus, the son, fulfills God's vision for Israel, God's true son is true Israel. So as Matthew thought about these events and he looked at the cross and the resurrection, he was seeing that in Jesus, historical events were repeating themselves and they were intensifying. That from the very beginning of Jesus's life, Israel's story, a story which Matthew knew very well, the story was being repeated. It was being recapitulated in Jesus. And he wants you to see it because this story is not just important for one nation, it's important for all nations, not just one people, but all peoples. Jesus, the true and new Israel is being saved again, rescued that he might save and rescue. King that in his birth is being posed by a king, an exodus out of Egypt to seek refuge going into Egypt. Now, why is he going into Egypt? How could it be that out of Egypt he called my son and he goes into Egypt? Because this time the land of idolatry and oppression is in fact the land of Israel. Out of spiritual Egypt, God is calling his new son, his true son. The baby is rescued to rescue. He will rescue his people from idols. So Jesus was born in very real historic circumstances while his people were yet again living under the great superpower of their day, the great power of Rome. And the people for whom God had powerfully brought an exodus had tragically once again turned from the living God to idols. So they lived under the power of another, not because of military weakness, but because of spiritual weakness. And so this baby born in the midst of conflict is good news of great joy because he will rescue his people not from physical slavery, but spiritual. Out of Egypt, I called my son. So why is the birth of Jesus both good news and a source of division? Because here is the baby who came into a world of idols to confront the idols and to rescue his people from the idols. Idols is a word that can be used easily. What is an idol? It is something that you worship other than God. One of the main messages of the prophets, especially Isaiah, is that the true God is supreme over the idols. That the idols, as powerful as they are an illusion, while the covenant God is the reality. Now, for some of you, idols are what you make with your hands. You have made idols. Others, idols are what you treasure in your hearts. Idols can be false gods. They can be good things that you make into ultimate things. Israel as a people had turned from the true God to the idols, and so God had turned them over to their sin. And what they needed was a greater exodus, a deliverance. And their covenant Lord was the God of the Exodus. They were hoping that just like in the original Exodus, God would from first to last rescue them. Do you see how God had forged his people's hope for centuries? He had forged his people to put their hope in this fact that no power in this world could stop God from bringing an exodus, all for the sake of his son. So when you read, out of Egypt, I called my son, remember, there is no power in this world that is a match for God. As you think about your own heart, what idols have you treasured? Have you believed are greater than God? Calvin rightly said that our hearts are perpetual idol factories. We have these holes in our hearts that are God-sized. They must be filled. God alone can satisfy them. We have to fill them with something. And by nature, whatever that something is will not satisfy our hearts. They can be filled at times with things we think are good. We endlessly do good things for other people. We chase money and we think that will satisfy or pleasure. Or consciously we worship another god. But idols never satisfy. They take, they never give, they demand, they never give rest. They offer a kind of glory, but a glory that falls infinitely short of the glory of the true God. But the good news of the coming of Jesus into the world is that this baby born came to rescue his people from spiritual slavery. from idols, idols that call you to work, 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 but never give you lasting rest. Every false god that we come to is like a band-aid for a hole that only God himself can fill. Brothers and sisters, the birth of this king who came from sinners for sinners is good news because he came for real sin and real sinners. What so tempts you and tries you, he conquered. What surprises you about yourself does not surprise him about you. I think part of the problem of sentimentalizing the birth of Jesus is that it sees this birth and the world through rose-colored glasses when Jesus came into the world seeing the world exactly as it is. He sees you, he sees me exactly as we are. And he came, born of woman, born under the law, subjecting himself to life and fallen world and human flesh and all the difficulties that come with that. And our eyes are meant to be readjusted to see the birth of this baby and all of this weakness as God's power. To see that the idols that we run to that seem to have such power are ultimately weak, but that Jesus is not. In the birth of Jesus, your sight is meant to be adjusted to see that what this world dismisses as weakness is the power of God, from the manger to the cross. Out of Egypt, I called my son means that Yahweh the Lord will make his power over all the powers of and gods of this age visible. It means that Yahweh, who saved his people from slavery to Egypt, saves his people from slavery to the idols. In Jesus, God's unique one and only Son, God is once again working to save decisively without our help. And Matthew means for us all to see it. So by angelic revelation, Joseph stayed with Mary. And by angelic revelation, Joseph led his precious family in this exodus to Egypt. In the birth of Jesus, we have the exodus of God's Son, that this Son, through the cross, might bring about the ultimate exodus, the exodus of his people from sin to salvation. Matthew begins with exodus, and he moves to exile. Exile, verses 16 through 18. We see that in response to the birth of Jesus, there was unashamed worship and there was indiscriminate killing. When the wise men did not return to King Herod, he was furious. If he couldn't know more about the location, the circumstances of this male child, he would kill all of the male children, not just in Bethlehem, but to be sure, all of the surrounding area, 2 years old and under. Now, from the histories that we have that have survived from the ancient world, we find no record of this account, but it shouldn't be dismissed on that basis. Herod was a cruel ruler. He executed his own wife. He executed several of his own sons because he perceived them to be threats to his power. Surely, if he were to do that to his own family, he would have been more than willing to do something like this to what were perhaps no more than 20 to 30 young boys. In the wider world of Rome, this would have been an afterthought to the historians of that day, much like in our wider world. The killing of unborn babies is an afterthought to society after society. What happened there in Bethlehem was just another chapter in the long story of God's work in the world since the beginning, right from the very beginning when sin made its terrible entrance into the world. God told Eve that her offspring would bruise, would crush the head of the serpent's offspring, and the offspring of the serpent would seek to destroy the offspring of the woman. And right from the beginning, there was conflict. Cain killing Abel. Abraham going down to Egypt. Even the Exodus itself, when God's people were slaves, God preserved his people again and again when it looked like they were on the very brink of being wiped out. And he did that so that from them, this baby would be born. Jesus was born into a world in which the world powers wanted to kill him. The circumstances of his birth were strangely like that of his own people, of Moses himself in the Exodus. Just as the Pharaoh sought to kill all the Hebrew boys because he feared the Hebrew boys would proved to be too strong, so Herod sought to kill all of the male children in Bethlehem. And just as the Lord providentially and powerfully rescued Moses, so the Lord powerfully and providentially rescued Jesus, and he did so in both cases for the sake of the salvation of his own people. That through the baby born, the Lord might work a powerful and public redemption. Matthew means for you to see that in this baby, history was repeating itself, and it was intensifying. His original readers were to see our story in this story, to think this sounds very familiar. And they were meant to see that so that they might see just who the baby really is. Just as in the Exodus, so in Bethlehem, this is the baby on whom the hope of multitudes hang. And like with Moses, this is the baby through whom the Lord will work a mighty, and if we know the Exodus, a surprising salvation for his people in exile. Like the Pharaoh of Egypt millennia before, Herod had no idea what a foolish quest he was on. And like the Pharaoh many before, Herod sought to wipe out the seed of the woman. The great, powerful Pharaoh was so easily tricked. The great, powerful Pharaoh who could indiscriminately murder these baby boys couldn't destroy the one baby that threatened him. And once again, with the birth of this baby, the powerful would trust in their power and they would be upended by what is weak. Herod's wicked plans only fulfilled God's purposes. So in this event, once again, Matthew verses 17 through 18 sees fulfillment. And this time the fulfillment comes from the prophet Jeremiah. Jeremiah persevered in the midst of a hard ministry. He was persecuted. He was oppressed. He prophesied to God's hard-hearted people in the time of the Babylonian exile, this exile which was central to the genealogy of Matthew. And Jeremiah spoke of the lamentation and the weeping that was heard in Ramah. Ramah was, or is, about 8 kilometers north of Jerusalem. It's not far from Bethlehem. It was along this road to Bethlehem that Rachel was buried, and the young men of Israel were visibly and memorably carried off into exile to Babylon. In Jeremiah 31, a chapter of actual great hope, Jeremiah writes about Rachel, who was Jacob's wife, as the one who personifies the mothers of Israel mourning for their children who had been removed from the land and taken into exile. The exile was the funeral of the nation. In exile, Israel was considered dead. They are, as Matthew says in verse 18, no more. And like Jeremiah's own day, Jesus comes to save a people who are as good as dead. Not only is the baby child in exile, so also are the people. Jesus was born to rescue a people from idols, and he came into a world of death to rescue his people from exile, from death, exile from God's presence. So the incarnation means that God becomes present in the world because God takes the fundamental problem of the world deadly, seriously. We live in a world in which death has become so sanitized, It's become normal. In some, not all of our cultures, we remove death from our sight. It certainly doesn't come up in polite conversation. We forget death. We put it out of our minds. We can become so accustomed to what should be shocking to us. We were not meant to die. We were meant to live. I think one of the greatest examples of this is at the very beginning of the scriptures in Genesis 5. It's a chapter in which the drumbeat of death is repeated again and again. He died and he died and he died. And most modern people are shocked when they read that chapter because they're scandalized by this list of long, long lives. But we were not meant to be shocked by long life. We were meant to be shocked by death. In that chapter, placed so soon after sin entered into the world, we see the reality of what Paul writes about in Romans 5. Just as sin came into the world through one man and death through sin, so death spread to all men because all sinned. Do you see here that in Jesus, in God's providence, he comes into this world of death, and by God's providence, he is spared from death. But he was spared because by God's providence, he was born to die. He would not be spared forever. What makes his good news, or his death, good news? Well, exile to a foreign country was not the greatest tragedy that faced Israel, his own people. The exile of sin and death was. Jesus' death meant that the reign of death in this world is over. Because Jesus, unlike Adam, did not sin. He obeyed, and he obeyed perfectly again and again and again. He fulfilled all righteousness, the righteous requirements of the true God. He did what no human being ever has done or ever will do. He kept the righteous law of God. He satisfied all of its demands. And so when he went to his death, he didn't go for his own sin. He substituted himself for the sin of others. He is the only one who could substitute himself for the sin of others, taking on himself our sin so that he might freely give righteousness. When he went to death, he went into death like no one else. He came out. He came out forever. He was born, he was raised, and in Jesus, the reign of death ended. And so because of Jesus, life no longer has to be lived in exile, away from God, but can be lived reconciled to God. Jesus was born into a world of tears, and his life and his death assure us that a world with no tears is coming. The good news of Christmas is that in Jesus you can find life, not by working, not by doing good, but by simply believing, responding not like Herod in opposition, but simply trusting him and finding life in his name. The greatest threat to Christmas is not that it will become sentimentalized or commercialized or marginalized by the world. The greatest threat is that it will become too familiarized by the church. That the incarnation of God the Son into the world, who would go to this lengths to save sinners, would become so familiar that we simply become bored with it. The baby born in the midst of death to defeat death is not something we should ever get used to, but become more and more astonished by as we plunder the depths of what God has done. It means that God is more committed to his people and his salvation promises than we can fathom. It means that exile was not the end of their story. It will not be the end of our story, but return will be, reunion will be. The incarnation means that your hope is greater and more far-reaching than you could ever fathom, and it depends nothing on you for it to be brought about. The lengths that God went to save you should convince you of the lengths he will go to complete the good work he's begun in you. It should convince you that this God who did not withhold his son will withhold nothing good from you. When you do struggle with doubt, reason from the great things God has done, like coming into the world in these circumstances to convince yourself of the trustworthiness and your hope in your circumstances. Reason that the God who came near then to his people's tears is not distant from your tears and your worries. There is much in the world, in my own life, that perplexes me when I have no idea the why to the what. But when I stare at the incarnation, when I stare at the cross, what God has done in coming near in his Son, my need to know why is diminished by staring at who? At staring at Jesus Christ and all of his goodness and all of his grace and mercy. He is more than enough for us in our brief time of exile in this world. He was a baby born for exiles. But be certain that while we are in exile, in Christ, there is always return. And that's how we close this section. Return, verses 19 through 23. Verse 19, Herod died. Right after his attempt to kill this child, we read briefly, Herod died. Just like the great Pharaoh, Herod's small part in this great story was over. But what happens? Once again, verses 19 through 20, through the special revelation of an angel, commands Joseph to rise and take the child back. Joseph rises and he takes the child and his mother back to Israel, for those who sought the child's life are dead. It's over. By Joseph's obedience, Jesus returns to the land of Israel, the land of his people. But Archelaus, Herod the Great's son, was now reigning over Judea. Archelaus was hated by the Jews. He had a very brief reign before he was deported and deposed by Rome. Ultimately, verse 22, Joseph is warmed in a dream again. The family goes to Galilee, specifically verse 23. They went to Nazareth, a very small village in Galilee, probably no more than 500 people. And they did so, as Matthew reflects on it, because it was Jesus's prophetic destiny, so that what was spoken by the prophets might be fulfilled, that he would be called a Nazarene. Except there is no specific Old Testament prophet that said this. Matthew sees Jesus's return to Nazareth as fulfilling a general theme, not of one prophet, but of a number of prophets. He was predicted to be despised in the same way this small village was despised, thought nothing of, overlooked. I think it's also possible that Matthew is using a word play here. The Hebrew word for Nazareth sounds like the word for branch, a messianic title. So here is the baby who returns to fulfill his destiny, to be despised, to come from a place that was rejected because he was a man who would be rejected. What do we have in Jesus? We have a Jew and we have something new. In Jesus, we have new and true Israel. The rest of Matthew's gospel bears this out. But notice that in this birth story, we see this man who his very life is marked by exodus, exile, and return, because he came to fulfill the hopes and the destiny of a people whose life together was marked by exodus and exile and return. And so to know Jesus, the baby born to die, this is the pattern. The exodus leads to the greater exodus. Exodus by water, exodus, deliverance by the cross. To be delivered by the cross is to live as an exile in this world, where we live by faith in view of the day of our full return, when faith becomes sight and Jesus returns and we enter the new creation forever. The baby born in the manger was not a neutral event then. It is not a neutral event now. Here was a baby delivered from death that he might die to deliver his own from death. In this baby, God brings about the ultimate deliverance, the deliverance from the domain of darkness, transferring all who trust in him to the kingdom of his beloved Son, through whom we have redemption, the forgiveness of sin. The baby born in weakness becomes the one who dies and is raised up by the power of God. As you look at the incarnation, think about it deeply, but don't stop there. Rejoice with great joy, because the birth of this baby means that the God who is keeps his promises. He not only sets the hopes of his people far beyond we could ever fathom, but he has the power to fulfill our hopes, every one of them. On this Christmas, I hope you will think about the staggering, fantastic fact of the incarnation, that in this baby, God's only begotten Son came into this weary world of weeping to bring everlasting joy. Hark, hear the angel sing and give glory to the newborn King.